Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. This week we've got a great conversation with the amazing Ian Rankin. Before we start, I want to tell you about a way you can find out more about what I'm reading, what I'm writing, and a place to join me for some book chat. Lots of you have already found me at the Creative Confidence Clinic. It's a space where I'm sharing essays, book recommendations, and reading and writing tips and tricks. It's where you can be the first to find out about my new books, projects, and events that I'm hosting. Go to creativeconfidenceclinic.substack.com for more information. Now to our guest. It's another icon, Rebus creator, literary superstar, and fellow Jilly Cooper fan, Ian Rankin. We're celebrating Ian's brand new standalone Amazon Originals book, The Rise, which is out on the 1st of November. We talked about Jilly, obviously, and Muriel Spark, Bumpy Starts, Scotland in Fiction, Ghosts, and Ian's appearance in Potbitch. I'd love to start with Muriel Spark. But yeah, I'd love to hear more about when you first started reading her and what it is about their stories that you love.
Well, I read the Prime of Miss Jean Brodie for fun when I was quite young. I would have been in my teens. But that was the only book of hers that I had read. And I think I only read it because it was set in Edinburgh, and I thought I should read this. But also I'd seen the film, and I loved the film, and it's possible that I saw the film before I read the book, which was often the case when I was young. I would sort of books that I read were often books of films that I wasn't allowed to see, or films that I had seen. Anyway, I got to university, studied American literature, and then decided that I did not want to leave and go into the cold, hard world outside. And Edinburgh University said, well, you won't get funding to do a PhD on an American novel. And the lecturer that I was talking to said, why don't you do something on Muriel Spark? There's not much about her. So it was venal. It was venal because quite early on, I decided that although I was going to get 3 years of funding, I was going to use that 3 years of full-time funding to become a writer. I thought that's what Muriel would want. She wouldn't want me to write an unreadable thesis that would moulder away in a university library, unloved and unread. So I started reading her books, and I just loved them. They're on the surface, they can be light and airy and comical, but just underneath the surface, they're incredibly dark, as is the best Scottish literature. And she was my gateway drug to a lot of Gothic Scottish fiction, which eventually led me to write the kinds of books that I write.
I do think that she is underread. And as you say, that mix of the light and the dark is so thrilling. But I remember loving The Hot House by the East River and just also thinking, but what is this? What is she doing? I don't know where I am. I feel totally disoriented.
Yeah, they reissued Hot House by the East River recently, and I wrote the introduction for it. And it's a tough book. It's a hard book to understand. You're not quite sure what's going on, who's real, who's not real, what is happening here. A lot of it is based, we now know, I didn't know this when I was doing my PhD because there was so little about Muriel Spark's life, but some of it is based on her experiences during the war, when she actually worked with German prisoners of war and tried to turn them and make them into spies or make them into sources of information for the Allied forces. So, yes, an extraordinary book. And also her it's a very experimental book. And a lot of her books are. She was influenced by the Nouveau Roman, She was a big fan of Alain Robbe-Grillet. I mean, who the hell reads that these days? She was very European in her outlook. She lived in Europe. She didn't live in the United Kingdom for most of her life. And if you read Miss Jean Brodie, you get a sense of the kind of writer you're going to get. But every book is different from the book that went before and the book that comes after. So it's very hard to get a take on her, except that she is a very dark, satirical writer. And she's also written one of the most extraordinary crime novels of all time, The Driver's Seat.
I've never read The Driver's Seat.
Oh, I'm not going to spoil it for you. Don't see the movie. The movie that was made with Elizabeth Taylor is a bit of a mess, even though it was just reissued on DVD recently. But the book is, I think it's under 100 pages long, and it turns the crime novel, the mystery novel, on its head. So, and it's dark. It's the darkest book she ever wrote. So well worth investigating. But Miss Jean Brodie first, then maybe Girls of Slender Means. If you want a lighter book about being a writer, go to Loitering with Intent, which is one of her later books, which is fantastic and was shortlisted for the Booker Prize.
It's a little bit more writing advice in that than in that famous clip of her writing advice, which is like, write your name, write the title, write the book, give it to someone to type it.
That's pretty much it. That's pretty much how she did it. She used to, you know, she wrote all her books in school jotters, school exercise books, that she bought from a shop in Edinburgh. And they were the same exercise books she used when she was a school kid. And they stopped making them. And she went, this is a disaster. I can no longer write books. And so the bookseller who sold these books, James Thin, went off and sourced more. They sourced the right cardboard, they sourced the colour, they sourced the right paper, the lines and everything. And they had 40 or 50 printed up specially for her, which they sent to her in Italy, so she could continue to write. And I've actually, in the bowels of the National Library of Scotland in Edinburgh, they have a lot of her archive. And I've been able to touch, to lift up and hold my hand, the exercise books within which she wrote The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
That's an incredible thing. What a thrill. Sort of a happy, haunted object. But I think that's so interesting as well, to have that kind of talent, but be that almost superstitious about it. Do you have anything in your head like that?
I can't write when I'm travelling. I need to be at home in my office. And I've got the same desk that I've had since 1986. It's like a painter and decorator's thing for doing wallpaper and pasting wallpaper. It's just a very basic desk, which I bought when my wife and I lived in London. And we bought it in Tottenham Court Road and had to take it back to Tottenham on the tube, hilariously. It then went with us to France when we lived in France. It went back to Edinburgh and it's moved around Edinburgh. And, that is my desk. I can't imagine writing at any other desk. I do try and cut myself off when I'm writing books. I try and write every day when I'm writing a book, so it's 7 days a week. I am slowing down a little bit, so I do fewer hours a day. I used to write 10, 12 hours a day in a sort of dream where the real world just disappeared. I've got my pens lined up. I've got my chocolate bars lined up. I'm mainlining coffee as I write or fizzy drinks. And I don't show the first draft to anybody. I don't show the first draft to my wife. Nobody gets to see it because it is so rough and ready. And the first person who sees my work is always my wife. So it'll be the second or third draft before I think it is in a condition for her to see it. And then she edits it, basically. So by the time it gets to the publisher, my wife has already been through it with a blue pencil.
I think, you know, all the writers would dream of having an in-house editor. Although I should admit that my husband, producer Dale, is quite often I will give him 40,000 words of nonsense, going like, I'm terrible, this is written. He's, you know,
well, my wife, it's mostly, I print everything off. I'm kind of belt and braces. So although it's saved to hard disk and it's emailed to myself, it's also printed off at the end of every day. Mm-hmm. And so she goes through the printout, all these A4 sheets, and she writes in the margin. And I'm sitting there terrified. The more she writes, the more I know I've got to change before it can go to the publisher. And it'll be things like you're telling, not showing here. This is just an information dump. You need to find a more elegant way of doing this. But also my character Rebus, I gave him a dog. This is a mistake. Never work with children or animals. Having given Rebus a dog, I cannot now bump off the dog. So there's always a dog. And readers get very worried about the dog. Is he feeding the dog? Is he taking it for enough walks, etc.? So a lot of the marginalia that my wife puts will be, hey, Rebus is going to talk to this guy. Why doesn't he take the dog with him so he can take the dog for a walk? Or Rebus has been away from home for quite a long time. when is a dog getting fed and walked? So I've made a rod for my own back, really, Daisy, by introducing an animal that, and British readers, you cannot bump off a pet. You just can't. You can kill as many people as you want in crime fiction, but please don't kill an animal.
I remember Jill Mansell, of all people, saying that exact same thing, that the only regret she has about anything she's written is a story. And it was, you know, it was a very sad moment when the dog died. And, you know, I think the dog was sort of appropriately mourned. But yeah, she got, I think, hate mail. Just like, never doing that again. Would your wife admit to having a favourite of your novels?
She teases me. My wife teases me that her favourite of my books is my first ever book, which was never published. It was a comedy set in a Scottish hotel featuring a one-legged schizophrenic librarian and a child with special powers, supernatural powers. And she says she loved it to bits. Anyway, she teases me. I don't know if she's got a favourite amongst the Rebus novels or not. She keeps pretty quiet on that. She reads a lot of crime fiction, so she is the ideal reader for me because she knows if I'm nicking ideas from other people or if other people are doing it better than me and I should maybe then revise.
I think that's so interesting, isn't it? And I don't know how I feel about this because I'm always reading. And when I'm writing, I reread because it's safe. It's not going to get in my head too much because I know what I'm expecting. And also I think rereading is how I learn about technique and how, when I've loved something, what it is they've done. But and also it's good to know what contemporary people are doing and kind of and what's out there and what people want to read, I guess. But also, you know, that can get in your head. I mean, I suppose the, you know, the joy of Rebus is, you know, you've got that character and that voice and someone you know so well who's always going to kind of set the tone to a certain extent.
No, I mean, it's a wonderful thing, and it's also a curse, you know, because people expect another Rebus novel and it can't be different. It can't suddenly be a comedy, or it can't suddenly be set in an old folks home, etc.
So you're not going to do Rebus in space?
Not going to, no. And Reginald Hill did once do a D.L. and Pascoe in space, which was hilarious. But only as a kind of long, short story, not as a full-length novel. No, we're not going. Rebus doesn't even have a passport. You know, people say, oh, you're going to Greece on holiday. Maybe Rebus will go there. No, he doesn't have a passport. He doesn't travel. He travels as far as the pub. That's his orbit, as it were. So, yeah, it's a blessing and a curse. I mean, it's lovely to have so many words, so many books to write about the arc of one human being's life. I mean, when we first met him, he was 40 years old. He's now nearly 70. And we've watched him slow down and get illnesses and have to move along and retire and feel a bit useless and try and become involved in the world again. And all of that I've enjoyed the retirement books immensely, because this is about a man trying to work out if he can still make a difference in the world, or if the world still notices him. Can he force the world to notice him? The police force aren't interested in him anymore. They feel he should have retired and gone to Marbella or something. And he keeps sticking his nose in. And he finds it harder and harder. He can't, you know, if he goes to a police cordon, he doesn't get through the cordon the way he would have done a few years ago. So that's all been really interesting. And it keeps me on my toes. It keeps me interested in him as a character. But I do think the police procedural, which is what these types of book are called, is in trouble just now. Partly because I think readers have decided the police are not necessarily the good guys. We've seen stories from all around the world where the police are institutionally corrupt, institutionally racist, covering stuff up, etc., etc. So it's very hard to get readers to actually get on board with the police officer that you are giving to them. And the high concept thriller has become a thing. And as you talked about earlier, you know, books like Gone Girl, when it came out, I read it and I tore through it as a reader. And then I had to read it much more slowly as a writer to see how she did what she did. How did she perform this act that make this book what it is? And I looked at all these high concept thrillers and thought, I couldn't write those. I just can't write them. And I can't write them because I don't know what a book is until I start writing it. So the idea of having a twist prepared in advance is anathema to me. When I start a book, there's usually a murder or some kind of big mystery, but I don't know who did it. I've got no idea what's going on. And as my detectives are finding out what's going on, so I'm just looking over their shoulder, also finding out what's going on. And about two-thirds of the way through the first draft, there's usually a light bulb moment when I go, oh, okay, I know what's going on here. I know who did it and I know why they did it. But a lot of writers would find that absolutely terrifying.
I think readers know when someone's holding them at arm's length and they're going to dazzle them. And it's like, I'm not going to let on what's happening here. And I think sometimes that can be thrilling and delicious when, you know, whenever you read a book, whenever I read a book, I'm always, you know, happy to suspend my disbelief and be manipulated and go along with whatever is being presented to me. But I do think that thrill of discovery, it's the most reliable, unreliable narrator, I guess, isn't it? Because they're not omniscient.
Mm.
And you know, I think especially with crime, you want to feel, I think readers love those books because you want to be solving alongside.
Yeah, and you want a strong central character, which I've got with Rebus, quite charismatic, certainly much more charismatic than his creator. And then you've got the City of Edinburgh, which itself is an extraordinary character. And Edinburgh just seems to me to be perfectly suited for crime fiction because it's a city that on the surface seems very orderly and controlled and rational. But scratch the surface and you find a much darker place where terrible things can be happening and sometimes are happening. So it's that Jekyll and Hyde, which every city has. But Edinburgh just seems to have it in spades because it is the city of Jekyll and Hyde. It's the city of Robert Louis Stevenson. And I've got an inkling that the first draft of Jekyll and Hyde, which his wife persuaded him to burn, I think it might have even been set in Edinburgh. And she thought it was too close to Robert Louis Stevenson's own story, that he was persuaded to move the action to London to disguise how much of an Edinburgh book it actually was. But in moving the action to London or in setting it in London, it was partly based on a real character, Hunter. There's a Hunterian Museum in London, which is named after the guy who was a physician and lived in a lovely house where Leicester Square now is. And his wife would be bringing along Joseph Haydn for a dinner party or for a tea party. But at the back of the house was the laboratory where Dr. Hunter experimented on corpses and tried experiments. And if you go to the Hunterian Museum in somewhere in London, you'll find some of these experiments that he did. He was fascinated by science, but that took him into some very dark places, including consorting with body snatchers. And so there's a lot of that that's actually happening in Jekyll and Hyde. But it's also, I mean, it's an early book about good and evil. It's why do human beings do terrible things? And the answer in that case is through ingesting drugs. And Stevenson himself was taking some pretty heavy drugs at the time because he had a lot of illnesses. And the drugs he was taking, atropine, I think it was, were giving him nightmares. And he said the story came to him in a nightmare. But his wife didn't like it, Fanny. She was, no, this isn't right. And so she went out of the room, came back, and he said, I've chucked it on the fire. And there it was, burning merrily away. So if I could introduce anybody to a dinner party, you know, I would have Robert Louis Stevenson there, and I would say to him, what was the first draft? Tell me the first draft. And did you really burn it or did you hide it somewhere? And it's still waiting.
Did their marriage survive that? Because I imagine...
She was a very strong character. Their marriage survived it.
I was thinking about how, you know, other than Rebus, how little I know sort of fictional Edinburgh. But I'm reading a book at the moment that's set in Edinburgh and I think it's out in October. It's called Hazardous Spirits by Anbara Salaam. And it's set in the world of sort of mediums and spiritualism. And it's the heroine, her husband, who grew up in a children's home. And she's sort of, her family think, you know, she's married beneath herself, but also the family have had financial disasters and they've lost their sort of genteel, you know, upper middle standing. And her husband starts to kind of connect with the spirit world and go on like the medium circuit and, you know, sort of bringing shame upon the family by association. But also she's now in this sort of very glamorous kind of Evelyn Waugh, Vile Bodies-esque, you know, the sort of the salons and the parties, which is great fun. But yeah, I love the way she's written about that period of time, thinking about, you know, the laboratories and what people were trying to understand about science and how the world worked kind of around the turn of the century when we had so little information and there was such an overlap between kind of science and, I guess, you know, magic and the occult and the unexplained.
Well, that kind of brings us back to Muriel Spark, because one of her early books, I think it was The Bachelors, is about a guy who says he can contact the spirit world, I think set in immediately post-war London. And of course, he's a charlatan. But also brings us to Arthur Conan Doyle, Scotland's most famous crime writer, and always will be, because he was interested in the spirit world. He believed in fairies at the bottom of the garden. When these photographs emerged that turned out to be a hoax, he believed in it. And he had mediums trying to contact his son who died, I think, in the Boer War. And he fell out with his best friend, Harry Houdini, because Harry Houdini, a rationalist, said, look, this is nonsense. I can't believe you're being taken in by this. But Conan Doyle was taken in by it. I mean, he believed in the spirit world, I think, to the end of his days. Absolutely fascinating. So you get that circularity. And in Scottish fiction, it touches on the spirit world. It touches on not only mediums and the occult, but ghosts, a lot of great ghost stories, a lot of creepy things happening. And the Gothic. I mean, there's a lot of the kind of history of the Scottish novel is the history of the Gothic. Because even before Jekyll and Hyde, there was a book called Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner by James Hogg, in which a young religious zealot is persuaded by a charismatic stranger that he is going to go to heaven, whatever he does on earth. Therefore, why doesn't he start a killing spree? So it's one of the first ever serial killer novels. And we're never sure if the charismatic stranger is real, a psychopath, a devil, or a figment of a young man's imagination.
Let's talk about Conan Doyle, because I've read interviews where you've talked about how inspiring you found those novels and how much they've meant to you all of your reading life.
Well, you know what? I mean, I didn't read much fiction. I certainly didn't read much crime fiction in my early years, but I did watch a lot of TV and films, and it was probably the TV Sherlock Holmes that grabbed me before anything else did. And the various comic books, whenever there was a Sherlock Holmes type story in a comic book. Everybody who comes after Sherlock Holmes is enthralled to Sherlock Holmes. In some ways, the perfect detective, the ideal detective, someone who is always going to get the answers you're looking for, someone who's cleverer than everybody else around them, and a character who is malleable. I mean, he keeps being reinvented, even setting the stories in the present day in Sherlock on TV. We keep circling around this character of the detective as a force for good, but also a damaged individual. He's charismatic, but he is damaged.
I also wanted to ask you about A Clockwork Orange, and I think it was in The Guardian where you said that there were lots of kind of, you know, exciting sort of pulpy thrillers doing the rounds at school. And when you got hold of A Clockwork Orange, you thought, this is different.
Yep, A Clockwork Orange, the paperback, a friend of mine at school, his big brother's edition got passed around. And I still got it because he loaned it to me and I kept it. I didn't give it back. The story of my school days is a story of me stealing stuff. I've also got my copy of Catch 22 by Joseph Heller is the school's copy. It's actually got Beath High School stamped inside it. I loved it, so I thought, I'm not handing that back. Clockwork Orange, it was extraordinary because, I mean, I grew up in a pretty rough neighbourhood, went to, you know, it was all working class, and it was boot boys, skinheads, Doc Martens, fights, gangs, etc. And so a lot of the books that were being passed around were skinhead books, suedehead books, Hell's Angels, kind of very pulpy thrillers. Mm-hmm. And along comes A Clockwork Orange, which was much more literary. I could tell that it was a very stylish book. It was a beautifully written book, written by a literary novelist, not written by a hack. And I would try and write in that style. I just was very enamoured of it. And of course, I couldn't see the film because the film had been pulled by Stanley Kubrick, who made it, because of copycat violence. So in the UK, you could not see the film, and I wasn't old enough anyway. And the story of my life in books early on is really the story of me reading books that I wasn't allowed to see in the cinema. So it was A Godfather and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and French Connection and The Exorcist and A Clockwork Orange. It was a very important book to me in some ways. It got me into reading. I must have read it probably a half a dozen or a dozen times over the course of the next few years. And it got me starting to write. I was trying to write little short stories, little squibs that were in the style of Anthony Burgess.
I think it's interesting that we talk about how, you know, that's how sort of visual artists get started, that, you know, people learn how to paint by imitating the great painters. And you know, there's lots of pressure on writers to find their own voice, but I think you only do that by loving someone else's voice and trying to understand and trying to copy what that is.
Yep, I think that's absolutely true. And every writer that I've read, I've probably stolen from something from them at some point. I mean, Muriel Spark, again, in Loitering with Intent, her great novel about becoming a writer, says that writers, you know, we just loiter with intent, and loitering, we're watching you, and we're going to steal your soul, we're going to steal your lines or your characteristics, your little facial tics or your dress sense or whatever. And any stories you tell us or any stories we overhear you telling, we're going to steal those as well. We're magpies, what can I tell you? And so, yeah, the early books, you know, if I read T.S. Eliot at school, I would go away and try and write a poem in the style of T.S. Eliot. Song lyrics, I tried writing song lyrics in the style of bands I liked. Terrible prog rock lyrics for bands that didn't exist. Well, they existed only in my head and on paper. And all of it was just part of trying to become... I didn't have any role models. There were no writers in my community. I wasn't introduced to any writers or knew any writers, and I had absolutely no idea how you would go about trying to get published. So in the early days, it was just reading as much as I could and then writing as much as I could.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We'll be back with Ian soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen Someone at a Distance by Dorothy Whipple. Ellen and Avery are happily married until Louise arrives from France, bored, heartbroken, and determined to take and break things. Dorothy Whipple is one of my favourite writers, and I think her final novel is exquisite. It's a subtly devastating examination of marriage, class and family. It's powerful, but never overwrought and completely gripping. Whipple's genius lies in weaving threads of lightness that illuminate the darker, sadder parts of the tale she's telling. This is a book of great gravity, but without heaviness. I will never forget it. Someone at a Distance by Dorothy Whipple is published by Persephone and out now. Now back to Ian.
Am I right in thinking that you did have a first novel very early on? When were you 19? Was it like right when you were at university and studying that you were published as a younger man?
Yeah, I mean, I was doing a PhD on Muriel Spark, which gave me 3 years of funding, and I'd already had a tiny little bit of success with some poems and some short stories. BBC Radio 4 used to have 2 short stories a day, one morning story, one afternoon story, and they took 3 or 4 of mine, I think, and that was a big boost to my ego to think that I was writing something that people actually were interested in and thought was good. And then I thought, okay, I've got these 3 years. Instead of doing my PhD, why don't I just use this time to try and write books? So I wrote 3 books in 3 years. The first one was never published, Summer Writes, my comedy, which my wife thinks is my best book. Then I wrote a book called The Flood, which was accepted by a very small independent publisher in Edinburgh. And that publication got me an agent. And the agent said, so what else are you working on? I went, well, I've got this book about a cop in Edinburgh called Rebus, which is my kind of homage to Jekyll and Hyde by updating the themes of Jekyll and Hyde to contemporary Edinburgh. And that book was taken by a London publisher, Bodley Head. And that was it. And, you know, by then I'd left university, was married and was living in London, scratching a living eventually as a journalist. But I thought I'd done it. I thought, right, I've done my one crime novel with this guy Rebus. And I went off and did other things. It took me a while before I came back to Rebus and realised, A, that he was my guy. He was the guy I wanted to write about. And B, that allowed me to write, to dig deep into the city of Edinburgh and what made it a unique and special place.
And I love the idea that Rebus was living in your head all that time and kind of growing and maturing, and that those stories were, you know, percolating, for want of a better word.
Yeah, well, after the first Rebus novel was published, I thought I wanted to be Graham Greene, the Graham Greene of The Human Factor, or maybe John le Carré. So I wrote a spy novel called Watchmen, which didn't sell many copies. Then I thought, well, I need to make a living, so I better write a big, fat airport thriller, a techno thriller, and that was a book called West Wind, and that didn't sell many copies. And I think my editor scratching his head saying, Lucian, I liked that guy Rebus, why don't you do another one of those? And that was the beginning of me writing a series. I didn't realise I was going to write a series until my editor said, nothing else you've done has made any impact at all. Let's go back to Rebus and see if we can make him work.
I loved the story in Potbitch about the Rebus walking tour and the many fans going into the pub. I hope this is true. I think Potbitch more accurate than most of the media. And you very politely sort of held the door for all these kind of, you know, Rebus Rankin super fans who, I think, you know, smiled and nodded. But that was, I don't think they knew they were in the presence of greatness.
Well, I mean, yeah, most people who, I mean, early on in the series, Rebus worked in a fictional police station and drank in fictional bars, et cetera, et cetera. But people in Edinburgh knew where I was talking about. I thought, well, why don't I make Edinburgh work for me, the real city? So I'll move him into a real police station and I'll start mentioning the actual bars that he drinks in. And the Oxford Bar was where I drank as a student, so I thought, and it was full of cops. When I was a student in the 80s, it was full of politicians, journalists and cops. It was perfect. So that was where I did my research, basically, for the first book. So I thought, yeah, this is where Rebus drinks. So, I'll be drinking in the Oxford Bar or standing there, and Rebus fans will come in from all over the world, and sometimes they recognise me and sometimes they don't. And, you know, I've often been standing at the bar with my back to them as they walk in and they take a photograph and they sort of wander around and they walk back out again. Well, everybody standing at the bar has a little chuckle to think that they didn't recognise me. And, you know, I wouldn't if John Grisham and Dan Brown were sitting in a restaurant and I walked in, I wouldn't have a clue who they were. I like that. I like that even very well-known and big-selling authors can retain some anonymity, because we need that anonymity if we're going to eavesdrop on other people, loiter with intent, and steal their souls.
It's such a good idea to commit those sort of, I don't know, moral crimes isn't quite right, but, you know, the minor sins of the author. The fuel the work. I wanted to ask you about reading crime. Are you good at working out whodunit as a reader? Do you solve as you go?
No, I'm terrible. And most crime writers I know are really bad at working out who did it. I don't know. And same with movies. I never know what's going on until I get to the end. And you go, oh, okay. And I mean, that's great. I don't mind if people work it out. For me, the greatness of the crime novel isn't in the revelation of who the killer is. It's in everything else. It's what crime tells us about ourselves as human beings, about human nature, about the society we live in, about the injustices that go on, about the gulf between those who have and those who have not, about what having nothing can do to you as a human being, how it can crush your spirit and force you to make terrible decisions and do terrible things. All of that, all these huge moral questions, and the sense of place, the sense that when you read a crime novel, you're getting a very good education in a city or a country or a culture. You're finding interesting, charismatic characters that you want to spend time with. all of that you get from the crime novel. I think it's the perfect package, and that's why I enjoy reading it. If I'm going to go to any country in the world, on holiday or on tour, I will seek out the crime fiction based there, because that will give me a good primer in which parts of the country to avoid, in the country's history, its culture, its gastronomy. I might get tips on where to eat and where to drink. I'll get all of that from the crime fiction based there.
That is a genius suggestion. And I think Sky Arts needs to commission this travel show from you immediately. I'd love to hear some recent examples of crime books set in cities where you've loved. Is there anywhere where you thought, I'll read about that because it's set there, and then changed your mind and not gone on the trip?
I don't think there's anywhere I've not gone on the trip, but certainly, when I used to tour America, I would say, okay, I'm going to New Orleans, I better read some crime fiction set in New Orleans, or I'm going to Los Angeles, I better read some Michael Connelly or some James Ellroy. And for some readers, that might put them off. I mean, reading James Ellroy, you might think, well, I'm going to this terrible place that's full of corruption and murder and death and sadism and everything else. Michael Connelly, because the goodies often win, the good guy often solves the crime. I mean, it gives you a sense of reassurance that even if bad things are happening in the world, a sense of order will be restored at the end of the criminal investigation. So it's never put me off really visiting anywhere. But I do like going to cities, like going to New York, and you can walk around the New York of Lawrence Block, to give one example. And you know, you feel like you're walking in the footsteps of these wonderful fictional characters, and you're almost reprising their adventures by walking down the same streets that they walk down. And people can do it in Scotland. You can visit William McIlvany's or Denise Miner's Glasgow. You can visit Ian Rankin's Edinburgh, or all the other Edinburghs that exist that other writers are writing about. And I just think it's fantastic. I do. I love it. I love that sense that, you know, now the big thing in crime fiction now is crime novels set in on the Indian subcontinent. And so a lot of us are learning a lot about India's past and India's present from the crime fiction that's coming out of that country.
Oh, is there anything that you'd recommend?
And there's one writer who's not at all well known in the UK called Anita Nair, N-A-I-R, and she sets her books in present-day India with a very engaging cop at the centre of them. And, you know, her first book, from memory, is about cross-dressing and people being murdered because they're cross-dressers. And so she's actually taken on very pertinent contemporary issues and weaving them into a crime story. There are, you know, she'll mention kids who come in by train from the countryside, little kids, pre-teens, and are picked up at the station or by men who want to use them as drug runners or mules or whatever, or put them out to work on the streets begging and then giving the money to these men. This stuff goes on in real life, and she's flagging it up as an issue. So they're very issues-driven books, and I really like them. So Anita Nair is someone who should be better known in the UK, and I don't even think she's got a UK publisher.
Because I was thinking about, you know, what you were saying about those playground books and A Clockwork Orange and you know, not being able to see certain films, and that the sense of scarcity and being really excited and having that anticipation and it taking a little while to be able to get hold of the thing you want to read. And, you know, maybe that's a great way to recreate that, sort of look for these authors who, you know, deserve a wider audience and maybe don't have one here, and that, you know, you've got to do that extra bit of work to track them down.
Yeah, and I mean, thanks to the internet, that's easier than it used to be. Mm. I remember when I was at university, if I watched, there were sort of stories, short stories written by Thomas Pynchon, who was one of my favourite writers, and they hadn't been collected into book form, so I had to sort of scour America, write letters to people in America and say, look, can you see if you can find a copy of this magazine anywhere from 1961 that Thomas Pynchon had a short story published in, and maybe photocopy it and send it to me. It was that kind of thing you had to do. So you were becoming a detective yourself. But now with the internet, of course, you can just tap in contemporary Ghanaian crime fiction, contemporary Sri Lankan crime fiction, and immediately you'll get a list of names coming up and you can have a look at them and decide who you might want to read.
Yeah, that's how you get to know other places. You know, what are they buying to read at the airport? It's not all, it can't all be lessons in chemistry the world over.
No. You know, to wave a flag for crime fiction, literature in translation, the UK, we were very lazy until fairly recently. We just wanted to read writers who were writing in English. And crime fiction broke those barriers down. People like Stieg Larsson, Henning Mankell. It was the crime writers from Scandinavia and elsewhere. We wanted to read their books. And when publishers realised that these books could be Jo Nesbø, when they realised these books could be big sellers, they started to look for the next big Jo Nesbø or the next Henning Mankell. And they started looking at different countries to see, what we've done Scandinavia now, we've translated a lot of the writers from there. Where have we not translated books from? And so we're starting to get much wider types of books available to us that we couldn't have got a generation or two ago because we just weren't that interested in translating books. It was an expensive process and we had plenty of English language writers, so why would we bother?
That's what you were saying before as well about the way trust in the police, I think certainly in the UK and the US, that is diminishing, and that's going to have an impact on crime writing. I suppose it's interesting as well the way that other countries and places feel about the people who are supposed to be protecting them.
I mean, in a lot of these, in a lot of these countries, I think India is a good example. A lot of it is, your uncle is a senior cop, so they get you a job as a cop. You might be absolutely useless at it, but you go through the ranks quickly because you've got a family member. It's a lot of nepotism, a lot of back scratching going on, a lot of money changing hands for positions of authority, and it's corruption. And crime fiction, shows it up. It says, look, this is actually going on. Are you readers happy about the fact that you live in a country where this stuff can happen? And I think books, crime novels are starting to take on board things like Black Lives Matter and cover-ups in the Met, the Metropolitan Police in London, and officers that have for years been getting away with sexual assaults and other terrible crimes because their mates in the police were backing them up and covering up for them. This is all not only coming to light in the real world, but is being used by crime writers to make the point that we, the public, should be horrified by this. And what can we do about it? I think crime fiction, at its heart, is a political medium, and that again attracted me in the early days. The fact that Edinburgh was a city of great wealth and great poverty and had huge drug problem and an HIV problem in the 1980s, I thought, if I want to talk about these issues, the crime novel allows me to do it. A detective is the perfect character because a detective can move easily between the haves and the have-nots, between the overworld and the underworld, between the CEOs and the politicians and the disenfranchised. One character, a detective, allows you to move between all these strata and talk about them.
And talk them and have a reason to ask them a lot of questions.
Yeah, and those questions will have to be answered. If you're a journalist, people don't need to answer your questions. If you're a cop, people need to answer your questions.
I would love to ask you about, because I know, you have, you've written for screen and books have been adapted, and that your own relationship with reading has often been seeking out the stories because you wanted to see the movie and you couldn't for whatever reason. Are there ever things that you've tried to kind of to make work for screen that haven't worked out, or ways that stories have evolved that have surprised you?
Oh, all the time. I spent months with a friend of mine who's a screenwriter. We sat in an office and tried to get a film script done of Confessions of a Justified Sinner, a novel by James Hogg about a Scottish zealot serial killer. And we thought we'd got something that worked, and off it went to Cannes, and the script went to Cannes, and we had a producer, etc., etc. And we just couldn't get the funding, we couldn't get it off the ground, so that was months and months wasted. The thing I've realised is that if I can either spend months and years that might be wasted trying to do screenplays and things that never get made, or I can use that time to write novels, which almost certainly will get published. So I've kind of fallen back on the novel again. But I do like stretching myself, and to do that, I sometimes do take on a stage play, for example, and just see, because it makes you think about narrative in a different way and makes you think about the presentation of character in a different way. And so when Amazon came to me for The Rise, they said, look, it's going to have to be short, it's got to be read in one sitting, And I thought, you know, I've got this idea that I had for a film about this high-rise block in London, and as a murder of a concierge. And I just thought, maybe that's it. Maybe this is a way to make that story work. And so that was a story that had been at the back of my mind that I thought I was going to use in one medium. But suddenly another medium presented itself, and I was able to get into it. And it was thrilling. And so, yeah, I mean, I've done opera librettos, and I've done song lyrics. Anything that makes me think about storytelling in a different way is good for the brain.
I think so, that it is just that, you know, reconfiguring and that angle change. You know, something that is a short story or a shorter novel can be adapted really well, but anything very, very dense is a much trickier proposition. I just saw the stage play of A Little Life, a novel I really, really loved. I didn't enjoy the stage play at all. I mean, enjoy is probably the wrong word for that book and that experience. But I was really, really surprised by a lot of the creative decisions made in terms of the parts of the book they chose to sort of to put on stage.
Yeah, this is why on television a lot of the best crime shows in the history of television have been specifically written for the screen rather than adapted from novels. The Sweeney and stuff like that, and Kojak, I mean, you know, Columbo, whatever, there's lots of them. Minder, Prime Suspect, Life on Mars, these were not adapted. These were written specifically for the screen. And in the past, and right now actually, when adaptation of my books has happened for the screen, often they just use the bare bones of the plot, because the books can be so dense that there's no way you can present it on screen without having 20 hours to tell the story, and very few TV shows get 20 hours to tell a story. So they tend to cut it back to maybe the main theme and maybe one thread of the plot, and then rejig it so that it fits into 45 minutes or an hour, and it fits into a screen narrative that isn't going to confuse too many people. I mean, in my books, I've got a cast of 30, 40, 50, 60 people. You can't always do that on screen without confusing the viewer. So I've been lucky in a way that I've worked with screenwriters who know what they're doing and are very good at taking the bare bones of the story and managing to make the theme work while compressing it.
Other than any books you've already mentioned, if we could guarantee that the screen version would definitely get made, are there any books that you haven't written that you would love to adapt?
I don't think I'm the person to adapt anything. I don't work well in a team. The novelist gets to play God, and I like playing God. Nobody sees it until I'm happy with it, and when I'm happy with it, usually it's in publishable form. When you're working on a screenplay, the director, the producer, the money people, your co-writers, the actors, everybody might want a say in it. You're a very small cog in a very big machine. And the reason I became a novelist is I don't work well in a team. I'm just not a team player. It's why I can never be a cop, because cops in the real world, unlike the mavericks that we have on television and film and in books, they have to work well. They've got to be team players. And they've got to get used to being a small cog in a very big machine. And they've got to get used to the fact that they may start an investigation but may not be around at the end of the investigation when justice is done, and justice may not be done at all. So, yeah, for all those reasons, I think I would be terrible at adapting anything. But I'm very pleased that one of my favourite writers, Alistair Gray, is finally getting his work adapted for the screen, and has had a rave review at Cannes or Venice. I think it's a Venice Film Festival. Poor Things, which is a novel of his that I would have said was unfilmable, has been made into a film, and it's been made hugely successfully into a film. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that. Sadly, Alistair died a couple of years ago. See, he's not going to be around to see it. If any film could get made, I would love Alistair Gray's Lanark, the great 20th century Scottish novel after Miss Jean Brodie. I would love that to be made into a film, but again, it's probably unfilmable.
Well, you know, now it's starting. I didn't know. That's really exciting. I don't think I've read any Alistair Gray, but I've definitely seen it. I think we've got Lanark in the house somewhere, which I will definitely read now and hope that someone has the imagination and the ambition to make it. But I think that's so interesting about I think being a team player is the greatest lie on everyone's CV. The first falsehood you'd say in a job interview. And I suppose, you know, the joy of crime fiction is that everyone gets to kind of indulge in that fantasy that they could be. It's seeing a team most of the time working very, very well and doing what they set out to do. But, you know, at any when that doesn't work out, it's an essential part of the story.
Yeah, what the crime novel does is, if it's about a cop, what it tends to try and do is say to you, look, there is a team here just behind that door. There's a huge team working away, but we're just going to follow these one or two people, these one or two detectives. And I'll persuade you, as an author, I will persuade you, the reader, that there's an awful lot of other stuff going on, but we're just going to focus on these one or two people, and they will be there at the beginning of the investigation, and they will be there at the end of the investigation, unlike a real criminal inquiry, which can go on for months, if not years. So, that's one of the kind of secrets of writing good crime fiction, is to try and persuade you that there's an awful lot going on that we're just not going to show you.
Before we go, and I have many questions about crime that I'd love to ask you still. I could talk to you for hours about that, but I would love to know about the books on your pile or anything that you're excited about reading or looking forward to making time for.
I've just finished reading John Niven's book, Oh Brother, about his brother, a troubled soul who committed suicide. It's very moving, very funny. John is a very funny writer, and he can't help being funny. So although it's a powerful and a dark story, he does inject a lot of humour into it, and it's a great book. It's a real departure for him. He's known for his kind of scabrous, dark, satirical novels, and this is a very personal book. And yesterday I finished reading Julie Cooper's new book, Tackle, which is published, I think, in November, which is about football. People are going to go, what? You what? I'm a huge Julie Cooper fan. I'm a fanboy.
I wasn't expecting you to say that, but I've just read Tackle and I had a fine old time.
Rupert Campbell Black is back. He's bought a football team. They're in the lower leagues. He brings them to glory and everything else. Stuff happens. There's murder. There's intrigue. There's a lot of romping. A lot of puns. It's everything you would expect from a great Julie Cooper novel. And I think she's got her mojo back.
Thinking as well, when we were talking earlier, I think Julie is the only writer in the world who can get away with the demise of beloved dogs.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. I mean, they don't die violent deaths, but she's got horses that die, you know, and dogs that die. I mean, she's a real animal person in real life, and I think that comes across in the book. So although, yes, death is, of course, a natural part of the cycle, she's very good at writing about it because she feels it. She feels the death of animals really personally.
Wasn't expecting that, but I'm so delighted to hear it.
The other thing about Julie is every time I say something nice about her in an interview, she sends me a present. So.
Oh, yes. So maybe make sure that she hears this. We'll both get a bit of Julie mail. I'm going to cross my fingers for that. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Lovely. Well, it was lovely talking to you, Daisy, as well.
Huge thanks to Ian. The Rise is out on the 1st of November from Amazon Originals as an ebook and audiobook. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and created by Dale Shaw and me, Daisy Buchanan. To see all the books Ian mentioned, go to acast.com/booked and you can shop a selection on our page at bookshop.org. Find us and follow us on social media at YBooked, and if you're feeling especially generous, we would hugely appreciate a 5-star review. As well as helping us, you could be helping a new listener find the podcast and their new favourite book. But now I'll leave you with this from Deborah Levy. Be sure to enjoy language, experiment with ways of talking, be exuberant even when you don't feel like it, because language can make your world a better place to live. See you next time.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.